Government and ANC ideology are a perpetual constraint on business. Take mining, for example. It's the flywheel of the South African economy. Electricity is the number one issue. Now, the mining charter and transport and exploration are second order issues. And instead of acting, we score more own goals. And there really is no excuse for delays in self-generation, for example. The president should have had a signed directive at his State of the Nation address and said it begins at midnight. Instead, we have to wait for 3 to 4 months after Mining and Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe announced it at last year's Mining Indaba. Against this backdrop, this felt like a no-nonsense sort of budget where Tito was trying to reassert Treasury's primacy into the broader debate. There were no grand analogies with hardy, drought-resistant aloes or harking back to Trevor Manuel's plums. There was also no mention of Eskom's debt. But in the main, a budget that delivers reduced bond issuance, some small tax relief as opposed to the feared tax increases, and offers some more detail on things like PPPs and broader reorientation of government spending to more productive areas with higher fiscal multipliers, and it should all be welcomed. We've had a night to read through the annexes and digest the message, and so we hope there's not too much of a budget hangover. Let's welcome our panelists to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly in this year's budget. Annabel Bishop, Investec Chief Economist, Peter Attard-Montalto, Head of Capital Markets Research at Intellidex, and Keith Engel, Chief Executive of the South African Institute of Tax Professionals. Keith, also very well known for his leading role in the formulation of tax legislation at Treasury in the mid to late 2000s. Annabel, if we look at where we are currently, kick us off here, because we had an expectation in the outer years of a 4 trillion rand debt. That now still goes, in terms of the hippopotamus jaws eating our children's inheritance, to 5 trillion. What were the highlights for you on the revenue and the expenditure sides?
I suppose the highlight certainly was, you know, no tax cuts. I heard someone talking about tax cuts earlier, but I think, you know, that's very wrong. So certainly from a revenue perspective, you know, the highlight for me is that we obviously roll in with around about 100 billion overrun, which helps us a little bit in terms of funding some of these near-term costs like the vaccine rollout strategy, of course, also as well covering some of the pressure that's, you know, coming through from extending the COVID grants and loans. Of course, that was the primary focus in the budget straight off. But after that, the bulk of the budget was obviously spent on these other factors. And of course, you know, the currency, the strengthening quite substantially, the bond market as well, because of this reduction in the borrowing trajectory. And that brings us back to the expenditure, as you say, Michael. You know, obviously sticking to these expenditure targets in the MTBPS, that obviously is quite key. And of course, this strong line being taken on the public sector wage bill. So, you know, obviously getting the approval from the Constitutional Court, getting the ruling coming through also, but getting the approval to obviously have a different type of wage negotiation and bargaining going forwards, that's quite key for me, I think, on the expenditure front. You know, we obviously have seen, as I said, some help to on the social welfare area, but really we need to find ourselves in a position now where we do as much cutting back as we possibly can to obviously position ourselves for a stronger future. But as you quite rightly said, debt level is still extremely high. And, you know, it doesn't really change us very much from where we were in October last year. Sure, you know, you drop maybe about 5% from a peaking perspective, but we are still well above where we were February last year, well above where middle income and emerging market economies on average are.
And that brings us then to growth, because this all obviously changes with the denominator in that debt to GDP equation. And Peter, on the economic forecast, Treasury GDP view has barely increased. We've got GDP penciled in at 3.3% following last year's decline of 7%. And it then moderates to, on average, 1.9% in 2022 and 23. That seems to indicate that Treasury is not very confident that any of these much vaunted structural reforms are going to move the growth needle.
Well, this is really the fascinating debate at the heart of the sustainability of the fiscus in the long run, is what does all this reform that's been undertaken by Operation Vulindlela actually achieve? And when you really, I think, press into the forecast and into the budget documents, the 1.6% long-term forecast is embedding a lot of success of the reforms actually that Operation Vulindlela is putting in place, whether it's on energy or water, on other things as well. And I think that's the problem. We are not getting back basically to zero per capita growth with a lot of reform, a lot of stress around that reform as well. And that's the fundamental long-term sustainability problem for the fiscus. We get stuck at this very, very high level, close to 90%, with a load of shocks potentially hovering around us. This is not a reform package which Treasury is, you know, saying is going to boost most people's perception of long-term growth from, you know, zero per capita, 1.6-ish real growth per year, up towards, say, 3% or so that would more meaningfully deal with unemployment and with the long-term debt trajectory. We should remember through the peak, from the peak in 2025, 2026, to the end of the forecast, it's only falling by about 3 percentage points, which is very little considering the size of the shocks, whether it's the road accident fund, whether it's national health insurance, whether it's basic income grant. And I think that's still the problem. We are certainly seeing a better budget. We're better than the MTBPS. There's a degree of buffer penciled in now to this budget as well. But all this happening, as Annabelle was saying, at this very high place, vulnerable place in terms of debt to GDP.
And that's relative as well to our emerging market peers. I don't think many countries around the world are spending as a percentage as much on servicing their debt. I see 20% of government revenue, 20 cents in every rand is going to go to servicing our debt payments. And that leaves 80 cents for everything else, Keith. Keith, your overall thoughts on the budget, firstly, before we get into any of the detail.
Yes, okay, sorry. I mean, what I'm looking at, I think, was great relief, because there's been a quiet drumbeat in the background for several months now, really dating back till June, that said we need to balance the budget and increase taxes. And you've heard that the Davis Committee, there's sort of the solidarity tax, wealth tax. And once again, despite the drumbeat, the minister has rejected it. He rejected it before in our last budget. Now things got worse, so people said we must be deficit hawks and raise taxes more. And I think he recognized in this budget that tax increases are really no longer possible. So what you saw was he gave us inflationary relief on the marginal brackets. There's no discussion of a higher rate. We didn't hear a discussion of a wealth tax. When you take a look, the corporate tax he's committed to actually reducing now to 27%. Albeit it's got coming at a price of some loss shifting and interest deduction limitations. So you see that the minister recognizes that basically the legitimate part of this economy is tapped out. If he's going to get more money, it's going to be about better enforcement for those who are evaders. So that was the main message that I got on the tax side. Mm-hmm. On the expenditure side, from what I could see, is he's just, it's not a structural reform. It's mostly a hiring and a wage freeze to contain the wages. And I don't see any real structure shift that much to infrastructure, but the only way he can contain the patronage is to just say, well, we're going to hire freeze, we're going to limit the hires, we're not going to allow progressions, and we're going to just take a much tougher stance with the wage bill. But overall, at least the status quo will be maintained and we're not going to face more burden. So I was overall pleased with it.
On that issue of expenditure, Annabelle, how meaningful is this revealed reprioritization of government spending? Because a lot was made on the panel yesterday in the immediate response to the budget by Michael Sachs of the cutting back and health and education. But what we have seen in terms of wages, particularly amongst teachers, is above inflation increases for the last decade. That was clearly unsustainable. So this must be a welcome development.
So maybe just looking at civil servants on an overall basis, I suppose, the point really is that in an environment where we haven't obviously had the vast majority of the private sector see any form salary or wage increase or any type of remuneration lift, people also losing out last year on their dividends, moving out of rental incomes, all of those types of inflows has obviously really, brought it to heart for government that, the public sector can't continue to experience massive largesse while the bulk of the private sector continues to suffer. But, to have a quick look at this, if you have a look at expenditure itself, only about 12%, I saw last night, 12.2%, is really focused on economic areas. The vast majority of expenditure is still on all these basic services, which, obviously basic services includes free public education to those who can't afford it, as well as obviously healthcare and many others, or the otherwise vastly reduced costs to the consumer. And, of course, those still obviously are the social wage, as you will, that we offer, along with obviously social welfare, etc. So no, I don't think there was an overwhelming shift. I think perhaps some of the jubilation comes from the fact there is a shift at all, whereas in the past there wasn't a shift. If anything, in the past the shift went in the other direction. But yeah, I don't think it's actually meaningful enough. I don't think this budget is going to bring about any type of economic growth on its own, you know, from a expenditure shift. Obviously, there is still the infrastructure spend that has always been in the budget and often has not been spent. You know, obviously trying to cut back on the inefficient projects and cut back on wastage, that's quite a key point. And I like that part of the budget when they talked about analyzing, you know, a number of infrastructure projects and obviously, you know, looking to try and actually now get the right ones going and obviously remove any more expenditure on those. It's just not bearing any fruit. But overall, you know, I think it's rather going to be the private sector that drives economic growth in South Africa, and obviously from an expenditure perspective as well. And if you have a look, even in this Treasury budget, I thought it was quite nice. They finally put in a graph of the private sector, public sector split on infrastructure spend in South Africa. So that continues to overwhelmingly be on the on the private sector side. So really, I think it all depends on the regulatory reforms, and you know, particularly for me, also quite key as well, moving increasingly onto electronic platforms for the bureaucracy in South Africa. You know, if we look at the success of e-filing of the Biz Support platform as well, that just reduces interaction between the private corporate sector and, of course, the bureaucracy government, which in turn is very positive to increase efficiency and obviously growth and dynamism in the economy. Rolling that type of electronic reform out to other areas, whether it's your councils, you know, to get plans approval, of course, to home affairs and those other really difficult areas for the individuals to interact, also, of course, will increase efficiency in the economy, increase ease of doing business, and, of course, also reduce the opportunity for bribery and corruption to try and speed the processes along where there are just these very lengthy delays at the moment.
I want to come back to PPPs and infrastructure. And what we did see as well was some movement and commitment to workshop what the Treasury, Peter, has been working on over the last while. But before we get too excited, I guess Treasury has been working on this for over 2 years and still we haven't seen any movement. Were you encouraged by what we saw around PPPs?
I think it was an interesting strategic ploy. I think Treasury, you know, doesn't really want to change the procurement framework. It is very happy that it has this perfect global gold standard for PPPs. If you're doing nuclear, for instance, amazing, but not if you're doing a wastewater treatment plant in some small municipality. And this is the fundamental problem of South Africa's gold-plated PPP system, which Treasury doesn't really want to sort of deal with too much. But on the flip side of that, they know that I think the Infrastructure Office is actually doing remarkably little here in terms of actually being able to generate and move projects to bankability and to feasible projects. A lot of that list at the back that Annabelle was mentioning is all pre-feasibility, conceptual stage. And there's a deep skepticism inside the Infrastructure Office on the private sector. A lot of this is about state-led growth, state-initiated infrastructure investments. So I think the Treasury move is partly staking a line in the sand on this, trying to get a bit more of a private sector focus on infrastructure. And the only real way of doing that is through PPPs. But no, I think the proof will be in the pudding if they do actually move on this particularly quickly. But it comes back to the point on what moves the growth dial fundamentally here, and it's ultimately, you know, there's too much chatter of state-initiated growth, state-led growth in the SONA, and sort of reflected, albeit through a slightly more classic Treasury lens in the budget as well. And ultimately, we should remember that 70-odd% of investment growth in the country comes from the private sector. Moving the dial there, even a small bit, has a far, far bigger impact than trying to say get SOEs to invest more or create ecosystems around SAA like we're trying to do with SAA, for instance.
One of the contentious issues certainly that emerged immediately after the budget from Labour and from many of those on the left is that there's going to be reduced spending on social grants in real terms and reduced spending in real terms on health. And I just wonder how politically acceptable, Keith, that is going to be in this kind of environment. Something feels a little bit odd there. Surely that's got to be an upside risk to some of these numbers that have been penciled into the budget.
Yeah, well, you see, I was surprised by some of those reductions, especially on the health. Actually, the other social expenditure was quite a surprise as well. And I guess, you know, they're looking at what they can afford. The problem is redistribution doesn't grow the economy. So can you afford it? Now, at this time, it feels pretty mean to start cutting back on social grants right in the middle of the coronavirus and where things are. So that one was a definite surprise. I'm not sure what the thinking was other than the shortage of money. The other one was health. Now, we talked about NHI. Now, what was interesting in this budget was the silence on NHI. You didn't hear anything. So if you're cutting back, how are we getting toward an NHI? And this is kind of interesting. We've also had about retirement reform about 10 years ago. You know, we don't kill a proposal. We just quietly starve it to death. And it seems to me that the social old age grants, as well as the NHI, at least the Treasury, is quietly starving it. Now, can they sustain it? Well, I think it's going to be harder for them to sustain the wage bill, frankly. They're going to get more direct attack. But the other parts of the ANC, they are committed to that form of social grant. But I think at the end of the day, he's the minister, and while there might be a lot of crying and whining about it, the cuts are going to be there, and that's going to be that. Maybe next year they can come back on it.
Yeah, I think the bottom line, Annabel, there's a very interesting graph in the budget here, is that we've only got 7 million taxpayers from a population of 60 million people. 7 million taxpayers really propping up the rest of the economy. Now, I know consumers all pay tax at some form, yeah. but really, if you drill into those numbers, there's only just over 270,000 people earning above R1 million taxable income, and they're responsible for just over 38% of personal income tax. There really is a sense here that there has to be a recognition that this tax base is thinning out and rapidly. Was enough done to ensure that we start rebuilding the tax base?
Maybe not. And I think that's probably also a question for Keith as well. You know, the bottom line certainly here is that we're finding ourselves in a situation where we quite frankly are running out of other people's money. We've been borrowing excessively for a long time and plan further excessive borrowing as well. When you compare it to where the other emerging marketable income economies are, we've been dropping through the credit ratings. And of course, you know, our peers are now Turkey and Brazil from a Fitch perspective, BB-. And of course, if we drop low, we'll be moving into the realms of pretty much all the other African countries, you know, and not the ones who do very well either. So the reality of the situation is, as I said, we're running out of money. And of course, you know, having a look at the tax side of it, our tax buoyancy ratio is just not strong enough to absorb more tax increase. In fact, actually, it's actually, I think, going to render less. And I think that has been the real realization coming through in this budget, particularly from my point of view as a macroeconomist, having a look at the adjustment for bracket creep. You know, it's a very small sop to the consumer. Obviously, you know, seeing the increases in the sin taxes, the fuel levy, etc., counterbalancing this. But again, it's a very small sop to the consumer, but it's, I think, been seen as trying to be helpful to promote economic growth. Now, what we saw in the 2000s, and of course, we're not in that strong fiscal position because of the years of erosion of the past decade. But in the 2000s, we saw substantial tax cuts, and we saw the economy roaring along towards the 5-6% mark before, obviously, they decided to get rid of President Mbeki, and we had the financial crisis there. But the recovery never happened in the 2010s decade, the past decade. And instead, we have had a massive climb in taxes. Of course, now, we are obviously not looking to replicate that. We're looking for that tax, that cut in corporate tax of 27% next year, which is obviously very positive. But it just brings us closer to the norm internationally. It doesn't actually change our competitiveness. And for South Africa, you know, the big worry is that we're seeing a lot of immigration for many other factors as well. But I think, you know, really focusing on the efficiencies at SARS, and of course they're looking at base erosion, the buffering or the building up of the large business unit, all of those factors are very helpful. But I think my answer to you maybe is no. Yeah. But then what can they actually do given the environment?
And that's just the direct taxes, the indirect taxes that the wealthy are paying in terms of their own education, healthcare, services that are increasingly not rendered by the state. It makes that figure even bigger. And if you just look, Keith, personal income tax makes up 38.17% of the main budget revenue. So government is really looking here at 272,000 people for just under 15% of its total income. And these guys are mobile.
Absolutely. I think this is what the realization is. There's a lot of discussion about the Laffer curve. Now, the Laffer curve can be overstated, that, you know, raising taxes doesn't always get the yield. But there's a point in the market where enough is enough. And when you're reaching 40, 45, 50%, then people start tapping out. And so what typically they find is people start evading tax or they're leaving. And what you do see is, and I see it in my tax community, I see a lot of immigration of high-skilled professionals leaving. And tax is an element now. And people overall, they don't feel the trade-off is right. Other people are bailing out of the system. They're not doing all of the reporting, so they're undermining Keyswetter. They're basically reporting half their income or part of their income or overstating expenses. Because people say, look, once you're taking half my income, I'm sorry, I need to live, and they will retaliate. That's why people are going after wealth taxes. Now, wealth taxes, they're looking for that magic billionaires, but even them, a lot of those things have been set up and structured so you can't get at them. So the chances of getting that big amount is not really there. And I think whenever people talk about wealth taxation, they forget that we've done a lot of redistribution already in this budget. This budget is, and all the way through the last 20 years, even though we still have a very high Gini coefficient in about inequality, we've done more than any other country to level that playing field through taxation. And at some point, the people at top say, this isn't worth it anymore. I'm not getting enough benefit from what I'm paying in. So you're in a very fragile state. And that's why I think, you know, Tina Mboweni has basically said, we've actually stepped over the brink. Because when you look at it, if you're in a 45% rate, you add in the VAT and everything, you're probably paying more to government than you're keeping yourself. And so I think they're recognizing that they need to pull back a little bit and at most go after the evaders.
Yeah, and an interesting point in Annex C, becoming non-resident is going to trigger withdrawal tax on your IRA as well. And there's been a lot of talk about that. But I just, as we've got about 5 minutes left, want to move on a little bit onto the state-owned enterprises. And Peter, what stood out for you when you look at the state-owned enterprise side of the equation? It's now revealed that, I think in September last year, the business rescue practitioners have asked for the total amount to be $19 billion. Treasury said it was going to extend around $10 billion last year. So that amount is shifting up all the time after the Minister of Public Enterprises said that $10 billion was the absolutely final amount that we'd need to fund SAA. What stood out for you around the SOEs?
Well, I think the main thing is there was very little on SOEs at all. Treasury is still holding the line, not funding Dennel. Dennel is due in court on contempt of court charges for not paying workers despite a court order. No money for SABC, for SAPO either. And, you know, I think the new guarantee policy, which has now been put in place, which I thought Treasury could explain better in the budget, is also biting on this point. And they're not splashing around guarantees to allow banks to sort of backstop going concern, if you like. And guarantees it would be definitely called. No new money for ESCOM. Disappointing there was no mention of the ESCOM debt issue. I think it's actually quite worrying, Treasury's attitude on the ESCOM debt. We heard that in the press conference afterwards. There seems to be this sort of, it's not our responsibility to restructure ESCOM's debt. They can sort of do it themselves. And I think that's completely the wrong attitude. I mean, we've seen with the mess on SAA what can happen when with comms going wrong, with disinformation maybe circulating around the market. ESCOM is a much bigger listed problem. And I think Treasury needs to be the adult in the room on ESCOM's debt. And I think their attitude on that is certainly not helpful. And then on SAA, I think, you know, there's been a complete loss of trust about where we are actually on this and where the business rescue practitioners are from National Treasury. And hence, they've now made this additional $3 billion much more conditional on additional steps going forwards. But no, broadly, overall, Treasury has kept the line with just the $7 billion for Land Bank. But even then, you know, we have to ask some serious questions. Land Bank is not in the right place going forwards in terms of its regulatory structure, its long-term sustainability. So there's still potentially more money needed on that front in the future. So it feels like they've held the dam somewhat, but the dam and the needs on SOEs are still very much there in the future.
And still a lot more detail on those factors that constantly undermine government's ability to deliver. And I know there is some talk around Vulindlela going out on a bit of a PR campaign and drive, but there's still a lot of skepticism in the market that capacity issues are being sufficiently dealt with. Annabel, just as a parting shot, given the finance minister's frequent confirmation of the need for policy certainty in South Africa, is there enough in this budget to meet that goal, at least for market participants to say, right, we are now dealing with an administration that, while not completely delivering, is at least delivering a bit more certainty and the ability for business to plan?
Financial perspective, yes, because that's what the budget does. It only really provides allocation of expenditure and obviously information on borrowings and revenue. But from a state reform, you know, no, obviously the budget can't do that. And of course, you know, the reality is I think the state is still far too bulked up. I think the state still believes that it needs to increase its size, it needs to increase control of the economy, it needs to change the management and structure of the economy enormously towards that of a socialist direction. And of course, the reality of the situation is they are essentially running out of money. The borrowings obviously have hit, I believe, beyond a sustainable level. And of course, the place that we find ourselves in is that we are still having a very large government sector that costs a huge amount, and we are not seeing high levels of productivity. We're not seeing high levels of delivery. Yes, we have this drive to improve a capable state, but again, it's just not yet fully feeding through. It's taking such a very extremely long time, and of course, we've decimated the technocratic competence of the 2000s, the Thabo Mbeki. So I believe that it's been too slow. There's been insufficient amount of reform and change, and we know there's huge political upsurge against it. We know there's the factions coming through from the different political parties, and of course, in the ANC itself, and all of that makes the progress very slow. Doesn't help, however, the economy. Doesn't help. It doesn't increase our competitiveness. We continue to fall through the ranks for the ease of doing business, not because we haven't been doing a few reforms, but because we haven't been doing enough, or as many as other countries, and I think we are still at risk at some point of seeing further credit rating downgrades. So, no, I don't think there's enough certainty yet.
Wow, barely a pass, and that's a South African pass, what it sounds like, Annabelle, which is 40%.
30%. 33,
yeah, but barely over that, and with the footnote saying can do better. Unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to end it off. Annabelle Bishop, Investec Chief Economist, Peter Tarmontalto, Head of Capital Markets Research at Intellidex, and Keith Engel, Chief Executive of the SA Institute of Tax Professionals, with their budget review. It's still a case of a dam about to break, and Tito with his finger in the dam wall.